Chapter 2, Sin and Atonement. Now we turn to the second very important article of Christian faith. I must clarify, however, that all Christians do not believe exactly in what follows. Even some church leaders have deviated from the stiff dogmatic attitude of the church. Even so, the philosophy of sin and atonement is a fundamental principle of Orthodox Christian faith. The first component of the Christian understanding of sin and atonement is that God is just and exercises natural justice. He does not forgive sins without exacting retribution, as it would be against the dictates of absolute justice. It is this particular attribute of God that makes necessary the Christian version of atonement. The second component is that man is sinful because Adam and Eve sinned. As a result, their progeny began to inherit sin, as if it was infused into their genes, and ever since, all children of Adam are born congenital sinners. The third component of this dogma is that a sinful person cannot atone for another person's sins. Only a sinless person can do so. Based on this, it becomes evident why, according to Christian understanding, no prophet of God, however good or near perfection he may have been, could have cleansed the mankind of sin, or was able to rid them of it and its consequences. Being a son of Adam, he could not have escaped the element of congenital sin with which he was born. This is a simple outline of the entire doctrine. Here is the solution advanced by Christian theologists. The atonement of mankind. To solve this apparently unsolvable problem, God conceived an ingenious plan. It is not clear as to whether he consulted his son, or if they both conceived the plan simultaneously, or even if it was entirely the idea of the Son, and then accepted by God the Father. The features of this plan unfolded at the time of Christ as follows. 2,000 years ago, the Son of God, who literally shared eternity with him, was born to a human mother. As the Son of God, he combined within him the perfect traits of a human being as well as those of God the Father. Next, we are told that a pious and chaste lady by the name of Mary was chosen to be the mother of the Son of God. She conceived Jesus in partnership with God. In that respect, being a literal Son of God, Jesus was born without sin, yet somehow he retained his human character and entity. Thus, he volunteered himself to take the burden of the entire sin of those of mankind who would believe in him and accept him as their savior. By this clever device, it is claimed, God did not have to compromise his eternal attribute of absolute justice. Remember that according to this modus operandi, man would not go unpunished, however sinful he may be. God would still be able to exact retribution from the sinful without compromising his sense of justice. The only difference between this and the previous position, which was responsible for this dramatic change, is the fact that it would be Jesus who would be punished and not the sinful sons and daughters of Adam. It would be the sacrifice of Jesus which would ultimately be instrumental in atoning for the sins of the children of Adam. However strange and bizarre this logic may seem to be, this is exactly what is professed to have happened. Jesus volunteered himself and was consequently punished for the sins he had never committed. The sin of Adam and Eve. Let us re-examine the story of Adam from the beginning. Not a single step in the above doctrine can be accepted by human conscience and logic. Firstly, we have the idea that because Adam and Eve sinned, so their progeny became genetically and eternally polluted with sin. In contrast to this, the science of genetics reveals that human thoughts and actions, be they good or bad, even if persistently adhered to during the entire lifetime of a person, cannot be transferred to and encoded into the genetic system of human reproduction. A lifespan is too short a period to play any role in bringing about such profound changes. Even the vices of a people, generation after generation, or good deeds for that matter, cannot be transferred to the progeny as genetic characters. Perhaps millions of years are required for etching human genes with new characteristics. Not only this, even if by a most absurd and unacceptable extension of one's imagination, one could conceive of such a bizarre happening, the contrary will have to be accepted by the same logic. This would mean that if a sinful person repented and came out clean at the end of the day, then that act should also be recorded in the genetic system, effectively canceling out the effect of the previous sin. Scientifically, this may not happen, but certainly there is far more logic in this balanced picture than imagining that it is only the propensity to sin which can be genetically encoded and not the disposition to do good. Secondly, by attempting to resolve the problem of Adam by proposing that sin is genetically transferred to the future generations of Adam, all that has been achieved is the total demolition of the very foundation on which the Christian doctrine of sin and atonement is based. If God is absolutely just, then where is the sense of justice in eternally condemning the entire progeny of Adam and Eve for the transient sin they committed and repented? A sin for which they themselves were heavily punished and driven out of heaven in such disgrace. What manner of justice would it be for God, who even after having more than punished Adam and Eve for their personal sins, still did not have his passion of revenge abated until he had condemned the entire human race to a helpless degradation of being born as congenital sinners? What chance did the children of Adam have to escape sin? If parents make a mistake, why should their innocent children suffer for that mistake eternally? That being so, again, what distorted sense of justice does God claim to possess and to enjoy to punish a people who are designed to act sinfully? However much they abhor sin, sin is made a part and parcel of their mechanism. There is no chance anymore for a child of Adam to remain innocent. If sin was a crime, then logic demands that it should be a crime of the Creator and not that of the creation. In that case, what justice could require the punishment of the innocent? for the crimes of the perpetrator. How different from Christian understanding of sin and its consequences is the proclamation of the Quran, which says, وَلَا تَزِرُ وَازِرَةٌ وِزْرَ أُخْرَى. No one can bear the burden of another. Chapter 39, verse 19. لَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْأَهَا. God requires not of anyone that which is beyond his capacity. Chapter 2, verse 287. Compared to the Christian concept of sin and atonement, these declarations of the Holy Quran are pure music to the soul. Let us now turn to the biblical account of what actually happened at the time of the sin of Adam and Eve, and the consequences that ensued the punishment. According to Genesis, God accepted their apology only partially, and an eternal punishment was meted out to them, prescribed as follows. To the woman, he said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. To Adam, he said, Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it were you taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Genesis 3, 16 through 19. Mankind existed long before Adam and Eve came to be born. Western scientists themselves discovered the remains of many a prehistoric man and labeled them under different distinctive titles. Neanderthal man is perhaps the most widely known of them. They lived between 100,000 to 35,000 years ago, mostly in the regions of Europe, Near East, and Central Asia. A carcass of a fully developed human being has been discovered, who happened to roam the earth about 29,000 years before Adam and Eve were known to have begun their short-lived sojourn in paradise. At that time, human beings were physically just like us and lived in Europe, Africa, and Asia, and later during the Ice Age they spread to the Americas as well. Again in Australia, the authentic cultural history of Aborigines is traceable up to 40,000 years ago. Compared to these relatively recent times, a skeleton of a female from Hedar in Ethiopia has been discovered, which is 2.9 million years old. Now, according to the biblical chronology, Adam and Eve lived around 6,000 years ago. One may look back in wonderment at the reported history of human beings, or Homo sapiens, as they are titled in scientific jargon. Human suffering continues. Having read the biblical account of how Adam and Eve were punished, one cannot help wondering if the pain and throes of labor were unknown to woman until the beginning of the era of Adam and Eve. A scientist will be hard to come by who believes in such fantasies. Again, we have plenty of irrefutable evidence that man, long before Adam and Eve, had occupied all the continents of the world, even remote Pacific islands, and had always labored hard to survive. Therefore, to say that Adam and Eve were the first to commit a sin, and because of that, painful childbirth was ordained as punishment is totally proven wrong by the study of life. Even animals, who are much lower in the order of life, give birth in pain. If one watches a cow giving birth to a calf, her suffering seems similar to the pain of a human female. Many such animals, we know, inhabited the earth millions and millions of years before Adam and Eve. To earn one's livelihood with labor is common to man, but not distinctive at all. Women also labor for their earnings and livelihood. Before that, every species of life earns its livelihood through labor. This fact is the key motivator in the evolution of life. The struggle for existence is perhaps the very first distinctive mark of life which separates it from the world of the inanimate. It is a natural phenomenon, with nothing whatsoever to do with sin. Again, if this be the punishment prescribed as a consequence of Adam and Eve's sin, then one wonders what would happen after atonement. If Jesus Christ atoned for the sins of the sinful human beings, was the punishment prescribed for the sin abolished after the crucifixion? Did those who believed in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, if they were women, cease to have painful childbirth? Did the believing men start earning their livelihood without exerting manual labor? Did the propensity to sin cease to pass on to the future generations and innocent children started being given birth to? If the answer to all of these questions were to be yes, then of course there would be some justification in seriously contemplating the Christian philosophy of sin and atonement. But alas, the answer to all these questions are no, no, and no. If nothing seems to have changed since the crucifixion, both in the Christian and non-Christian worlds, then what would be the meaning of atonement? Even after Jesus Christ, the sense of common justice continues to dictate to human beings all over the world that if any person commits a sin, punishment of that sin has to be given to that person alone and to none else. Every man and woman must suffer the consequences of their sins by themselves. Children are always born innocent. If this is not the truth, then God's attribute of justice is thrown overboard. We as Muslims believe that all divine books are based on eternal truth, and none can make any claims contrary to that. When we come across inconsistencies and contradictions in any so-called divinely revealed book, our attitude is not that of total denial and rejection, but that of cautious and sympathetic examination. Most of the statements of the Old Testament and the New Testament, which we find at variance with the truth of nature, we either try to reconcile by reading some underlying cryptic or metaphoric message, or reject part of the text as the work of human hands rather than that of God. While Christianity itself was true, it could not have contained any distortions, unacceptable facts, or beliefs giving a lie to nature. That is why we started not with the textual examination but with the fundamentals themselves, which through centuries of consensus have become indisputable components of Christian philosophy. Rudimentary among them are the Christian understanding of sin and atonement. I would much rather believe that someone, somewhere, during the history of Christianity, misunderstood things and tried to interpret them in the light of his knowledge and misled the following generations because of that. inherited sin. Let us suppose, for the sake of argument, that Adam and Eve sinned literally as prescribed in the Old Testament and were duly punished. As the story goes, the punishment was handed out not only to them, but to their entire progeny. Once that punishment was prescribed and delivered, why was there the need for any other punishment at all? Once a sin has been punished, it is done with. Once a judgment has been passed, no one has the right to continuously add more and more punishments. In the case of Adam and Eve, it is not only that they were severely reprimanded, and if anything, more than punished for the sin they had committed, but also the nature of the punishment which was extended to their progeny in itself is highly questionable. Of that we have said enough. What we are attempting to point to is a far more heinous violation of absolute justice. To be punished continuously for the sins of our forefathers is one thing, but to be compelled to continue to sin as a consequence of one's forefathers' error is simply abominable. Let us get down to the hard realities of human experience and try to understand the Christian philosophy of crime and punishment in relation to our everyday experience. Let us suppose a judgment is passed against a criminal, which is far too severe and harsh in proportion to the crime committed. That could, of course, lead to loud and severe condemnation of such a gross, disproportionate penalty by every sensible man. In view of this, we find it very difficult to believe that the penalty imposed on Adam for his sin came from a just God. It is not just a case of an out-of-proportion penalty. It is a penalty that, according to the Christian understanding of God's conduct, outlived the lifespan of Adam and Eve and was extended generation after generation to their progeny. For the progeny to suffer for the punishment of their parents is actually an extension of the violation of justice beyond its ultimate limits. But we are not talking of that either. If we had the misfortune to observe a judgment passed by any contemporary judge, making it compulsory for the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, etc., of a criminal to be coerced by law to continue to sin and commit crimes and be punished accordingly till eternity, then what would be the reaction of contemporary society, which has acquired a universal sense of justice through civilization? In the 5th century, Augustine, the bishop of Hippo, was involved in a confrontation with the Pelagian movement concerning the controversy of the nature of the fall of Adam and Eve. He proclaimed the Pelagian movement as being heretical because it taught that Adam's sin affected only himself and not the human race as a whole, that every individual is born free of sin and is capable in his own power of living a sinless life, and that there had been persons who had succeeded in doing so. Those in the right were labeled as heretics. Day was denounced as night, and night as day. Heresy is truth, and truth heresy. The transfer of sin. Let us now re-examine the theme that God does not forgive the sinful without punishing them because it is against his sense of justice. One is horrified to realize that for century after century, Christians have believed in something which is most certainly beyond the grasp of the human intellect and contrary to human conscience. How on earth, or heaven for that matter, Could God forgive a sinful person merely because an innocent person has volunteered himself to take the punishment instead? The moment God does so, he violates the very fundamental principles of justice. A sinful person must suffer for his sins. In short, a multitude of complex human problems would arise if the punishment is transferred to someone else. It is argued by Christian theologians that such a transfer of punishment does not violate any principle of justice because of the voluntary acceptance by the innocent person of the other person's punishment. What would you say in the case of a debtor, they ask, who is overloaded with debts beyond his capacity to pay, and some God-fearing philanthropist decides to relieve him of his burden by paying his entire debts on his behalf? Our answer would be that indeed we would loudly applaud such an act of immense generosity, kindness, and sacrifice. But what would be the reaction of the person who confronts us with such a question? If the debt payable runs into trillions of pounds sterling, and there steps forward a philanthropist who takes out a penny from his pocket, demanding that all that is due to the debtor should be cancelled out against that kindly penny offered as a substitute for that debt. What we have in the case of Jesus Christ offering himself to be punished for the sins of all humanity is far more grotesquely unproportionate. Again, it is not only one debtor or all the debtors of one single generation, but we are talking about billions of born and unborn defaulters extending up to doomsday. But that is not all. To conceive of crime as only a debtor who owes money to someone else is the most naive definition of sin that I have ever come across. This scenario, which has been presented, deserves to occupy our attention a little longer before we turn to some other aspects of crime and punishment. Let us consider the case of a debtor called A, who owes £100,000 to person B. If a rich philanthropist, in full command of his senses, seriously and genuinely wants to relieve the debtor of his burden, the common law would require him to pay to B all that person A owed him. But suppose the hypothetical philanthropist steps forward with the plea that person A should be absolved of his responsibility of payment to person B, and instead he himself should be beaten up a little bit or imprisoned for 3 days and nights at the most in his place. If it really happened in real life, it would be a treat to watch the horrified faces of the astounded judge and the confounded poor creditor B. But the philanthropist has yet to complete his plea for clemency. He would further stipulate, "O my Lord, that is not all I want in return for my sacrifice. I require all the debtors of the entire kingdom alive today or to be born until the end of time to be absolved of their dues in return for my suffering of 3 days and nights." At this point, one's mind boggles. How one wishes to propose to God, the just God, that at least those who had been robbed of the fruits of their labor or of the savings of their lives should have been compensated to some degree at least. But the Christian God, it seems, is far more kind and clement to the criminal than to the innocent who suffer at the hands of the criminal. A strange sense of justice indeed, which results in the forgiveness of robbers, usurpers, the abusers of children, the torturers of the innocent and the perpetrators of all sorts of beastly crimes against humanity, provided that they believe in Jesus Christ in their dying moments. What of the incalculable debt they owe to their tormented victims? A few moments of Jesus in hell seem sufficient to purge them of their long lives of unpunished, heinous guilt, generation after generation. Punishment continues to be meted out. Let us now consider a different, more serious category of crime, the consequences of which human nature simply cannot accept to be transferable. For instance, someone mercilessly abuses a child and even rapes and murders it. Human sensibilities would no doubt be violated to an unbearable degree. Suppose such a person continues to cause similar and greater suffering all around him without ever being caught and brought to justice. Having lived his life of crime unpunished by human hands, death closes in upon him, but he determines to elude even the greater punishment of the judgment day and suddenly decides, at last, to have faith in Jesus Christ as his Savior. Would all his sins suddenly melt into nothingness? And would he be left to glide into the other world free of sin like a newborn baby? Perhaps such a one who defers his belief in Jesus till the time of death proves to be much wiser than the one who does so earlier in life. There always remained for the latter a danger of committing sins after belief and falling prey to the devil's designs and insinuations. Why not wait till death is close upon you, giving the devil little chance and time to rob you of your faith in Jesus? A free life of crime and pleasure here on earth and a rebirth in an eternal state of redemption is no mean bargain indeed. Is this the wisdom of justice that the Christians attribute to God? Such a sense of justice or such a God himself is totally unacceptable to human conscience, which he himself created, without, alas, being able to discriminate right from wrong. Looking at the same question in the light of human experience and human understanding, one has every right to denounce this philosophy to be meaningless and without foundation. It has no reality or substance. Human experience teaches us that it is always the prerogative of those who suffer at the hands of others to forgive or not to forgive. Sometimes governments, to celebrate a day of national rejoicing or for other reasons, may declare an amnesty to criminals without discrimination. But that does not in itself justify the act of pardoning those who have done some irreparable harm and caused perpetual suffering to their fellow innocent citizens. It should be remembered that if the act of indiscriminate pardon at the hands of a government can by any measure be justified, and if this is not considered by Christian theologians as a violation of the sense of justice, then why do they not extend the same courtesy to God and concede to him the right of forgiveness as and when he so pleases? After all, he is the supreme sovereign, the creator, and master of everything. If he pardons anyone for any crime that may have been committed against fellow beings, the supreme master has the unlimited power to compensate the aggrieved so generously as to make him perfectly satisfied with his creation, with his decision. That being so, where is the need for the sacrifice of his innocent son? This in itself constitutes a mockery of justice. We are born attuned to the attributes of God. He so declares in the Holy Bible, Then God said, "Let us make man in our own image, in our likeness." Genesis 1:26. On the same subject, in the Holy Quran, he says, "Fitratullahi allati fatara an-nasa 'alayha," and follow the nature made by Allah, the nature in which He has created mankind. Chapter 30, verse 31. This tenet, common to both Christian and Muslims alike, requires that human conscience is the best reflective mirror of God's conduct in a given situation. It is a matter of everyday experience with us that many a time we forgive without having violated the sense of justice in the least. If we are wronged personally, then in respect of the crime committed against us, we can go to any length in forgiveness. If a child hurts his parents by being disobedient or by causing damage to some precious household article or by earning them a bad name, he has sinned against them. His parents may forgive him without their conscience pricking them or blaming them for having violated the sense of justice. But if their child destroys the property of their neighbor or injures the child of another person, how could they decide to forgive the child for causing suffering to others? It would be deemed an act of injustice, even according to their own conscience, if they did so. Crime and punishment have the same relationship as cause and effect, and they have to be proportionate to some degree. This aspect of the relationship between crime and punishment has already been discussed at some length with regards to financial misconduct of one man against another. The same argument applies with greater severity to other crimes like injuring, maiming, or murdering innocent citizens, or violating their honor in any manner. The greater the enormity of the crime, the more severe one would expect the nature and extent of punishment to be. If God can forgive all and sundry, as I do believe that He and only He can, then the question of atonement in exchange for punishing an innocent person does not come into play at all. If, however, it is a question of the transference of one criminal's punishment to another person, innocent person, who has opted for such a measure, then justice would most certainly demand that the punishment must be transferred in its entirety to the other person, without decreasing or diluting it to any degree. Again, of that, we have already said enough. Do the Christians believe that this dictate of justice was applied in the case of Jesus the Son by God the Father? If so, it means that all the punishment due to all the criminals of the Christian world born at the time of Christ or ever afterwards till Judgment Day was amassed, concentrated, and brought to an infernal intensity of such a degree that the suffering of Jesus Christ for merely 3 days and nights equaled the torture of all the punishment which the above-mentioned sinners had earned or were to earn till the last day. If so, no Christian should ever be punished on earth by any Christian government. Otherwise, that would be tantamount to an act of gross injustice. All that the courts of law should do after reaching the verdict of guilty would be to ask the Christian criminal to pray to Jesus the Son to save him, and the matter should be rested and brought to a close there and then. It would simply be a case of book transfer of criminal's account to that of Jesus Christ. For the sake of illustration, let us bring the United States of America into sharper focus and zoom in on the state of crime there. The crimes of mugging and murder are so widespread that it is difficult to keep account of them. Once, I remember in New York, I tuned into a radio station which was devoted entirely to the reporting of capital crime. It was a most horrifying experience. It was so painful that half an hour was the maximum I could take it, no more. Almost every 5 minutes, a new murder was committed in America and was reported, sometimes with grisly coverage by reporters who were actually witnessing the very murder in progress. It is not our intention to present a detailed picture of crime in America, but it is a matter of common knowledge that today America stands among the foremost in the list of countries where of all sorts of crimes are rampant, particularly in larger cities such as Chicago, New York, and Washington. In New York, mugging is commonplace along with the maiming of innocent citizens who dare to resist it. This daily occurrence creates a most obnoxious picture of mutilation and murder for paltry gains. Leaving aside for the moment the rising trend of crime throughout the world, in the case of America alone, one cannot fail to wonder about the relationship between the Christian concept of sin and atonement with the crimes committed daily. However much removed they may be from Christian value in their practice, at least this much goes to their credit that they do believe in the Christian doctrine of sin and redemption, and also in Christ as their Savior. Alas, to what avail? The majority of the criminals in America, of course, are so-called Christians, though Muslims and others are no exception. Just because all such criminals who belong to Christianity and believe in the reported voluntary sacrifice of Jesus Christ for the sake of the believing sinners, would they all be pardoned by God? If so, in what way? Ultimately, a sizable percentage from among them may get caught and get punished by the law of the land, but still a large number would either remain unapprehended or may only be punished for a part of the crimes which they may have committed over many years. What would Christianity offer to those who are punished by law, and what would it promise those who remain unapprehended here on earth? Will both be punished to varying degrees, or will they be punished indiscriminately? Another dilemma relating to a criminal's redemption because of his belief in Jesus Christ arises out of a less clear and undefined situation. If, for instance, a Christian commits a crime against an innocent non-Christian victim, he would be forgiven, of course, because of the blessings of his faith in Jesus. The punishment of his crime will then be transferred to the account of Jesus instead. But what would be the profit and loss statement of the poor, innocent, non-Christian victim? Poor Jesus and the poor victim, both being punished for a crime they did not commit. One's faculties are confounded if we try to imagine the enormity of all the crimes ever committed by humanity since the dawn of Christianity till the time when the sun of existence sets on human life. Have all these crimes been transferred to the account of Jesus Christ, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him? Have all these sins been accounted for in the small space of 3 days and 3 nights that Jesus is supposed to have suffered? Still, one keeps on wondering, how could the vast sea of criminals so intensely embittered by the deadly poison of crime be sweetened and cleansed entirely of the effects of their crimes by the mere act of their believing in Jesus? Again, one's thoughts are carried back to the remote past when poor Adam and Eve so naively committed their first crime, only because they were so cunningly duped and ensnared by Satan? Why was their sin not also washed clean? Did they not have faith in God? Was it a minor act of goodness to have faith in God the Father? And was it their fault anyway that they had never been told of a son living eternally with God the Father? Why did not the divine Son take pity on them and beseech God the Father to punish him for their crimes instead? How one wishes that had happened. It might have been so much easier to be punished only for that one single faltering moment on the part of Adam and Eve. The entire story of humanity would certainly have been rewritten in the book of fate. A heavenly earth would have been created instead, and Adam and Eve would not have been banished eternally from heaven, along with the untold number of their unhappy progeny. Jesus alone would have been banished from heaven merely for 3 days and 3 nights, and that would have been that. Sadly, neither God the Father nor Jesus thought of this. Look how Jesus' holy, lovable reality is unfortunately transformed into a bizarre and unbelievable myth. Justice and forgiveness. The Christian philosophy of crime and punishment is not only utterly confusing for simple, unprejudiced human intellect, but also raises many other relevant questions which are no less perplexing. The relationship between justice and forgiveness, as maintained by the Christian philosophy of atonement, attempts to explain why God himself could not forgive. It is dependent entirely on an erroneous and arbitrary concept of justice, which takes it for granted that justice and forgiveness can never go hand in hand. That being so, why does the New Testament place so much emphasis on forgiveness when the question of human relationships is discussed? I have never read in any divine scriptures of any world religion a teaching that leans more one-sidedly upon and overly emphasizes the role of forgiveness. What a fantastic contrast with the traditional emphasis on justice found in Judaic teachings. An eye for an eye for eye, a tooth for tooth. That is justice, pure, simple, and unattenuated. What a dramatic departure from this to the Christian teaching of turning the other cheek if slapped on one. Who gave the latter teaching that is against the earlier teachings of Torah? Was the first teaching of Torah, one is left wondering, a teaching by God the Father as against the diametrically opposed teaching of the New Testament, a teaching by Christ, the Divine Son? If so, why did the divine Son differ so drastically from his Father? Should such a conflict be taken as a genetical defect or an evolutionary change? Or was this Christian attitude of absolute forgiveness as diametrically opposed to the Judaic emphasis on revenge, an example of volt-face change on the part of God the Father? He seems to have dearly repented of what he had taught Moses and the people of the book and wanted very much to redress his own wrong. As Muslims, we observe this fundamental shift in emphasis and see no contradiction because we believe in a God who combines in him both the attributes of justice and forgiveness. Without there being any inner conflict between the two attributes, we understand the transfer from Judaic teachings to that of Jesus Christ not as a corrective measure of those teachings, but of their misapplication by the Jews. With us, God is not only just, but is also forgiving, merciful, and beneficent. If he so desires, he does not stand in need of any outside help to forgive the sinful. But from the Christian point of view, the problem acquires gigantic proportions. It appears that the God of the Torah was a God who knew only justice and had no sense of compassion or mercy. Apparently, he was unable to forgive, however much he may have desired to do so. Lo, then came to his help God the Son, and extricated him from his infernal dilemma. It seems that the Son was all compassion as against the all vengefulness of his Father. It is not just the apparent absurdity of this vision of the Son which disturbs the human conscience, but it also raises the question once again of the contradiction in their characters. Jesus does not appear to be a true son of his Father. A genetic error again, perhaps. Another important area of inquiry is the attitude of other religions of the world towards sin and its consequences. Christianity is, of course, not the only religion to be a revealed religion. Numerically, non-Christians largely exceed Christians. Thousands of years of the known history of man before Jesus Christ saw many religions born and take root in different human soils in various parts of the world. Do these religions ever speak of a philosophy of forgiveness even remotely related to the Christian dogma of atonement? What is their concept of God or gods if they have now begun to believe in many? What is their concept of God's attitude towards sinful humanity? Among the comity of religions, the nearest to Christianity is perhaps Hinduism in this regard, but only partially so. Hindus also believe in an absolute just God, whose sense of justice demands that he must punish somehow every perpetrator of sin. But the resemblance ends there. No mention of a divine son taking the entire consequences of the whole world of sinners upon his shoulders is even remotely indicated. On the contrary, we are told of an endless chain of crime and punishment in an endless number of reincarnations of the soul into animal flesh. Atonement only becomes accessible after the many times reincarnated soul has incurred punishment exactly in accord with the sum total of the crimes it committed during all its fateful experiences of reincarnation. To some, it may sound weird and bizarre indeed, but there is certainly some inherent justice in this philosophy, a balance and symmetry, which is in perfect harmony with the concept of absolute justice. Leaving Hinduism and other religions who also believe in the philosophy of reincarnation with all its complexities of cause and effect aside, What is the role of forgiveness on the part of God in the remaining major or minor religions of the world? All such religions and over a billion adherents of religions, such as Hinduism, seem to be totally ignorant and uninformed of the myth of atonement. This is very perplexing indeed. Who was in communion with mankind elsewhere in the history of religions? If it were not God the Father, as in Christian doctrine, was the entire religious leadership of the world, except Jesus Christ, pupil of the devil himself? And where was God the Father? Why did he not come to rescue when the rest of mankind was being led astray by the devil in his name? Or were they, the rest of the humanity, a creation of a being other than the so-called God the Father? Again, why were they treated in such a stepfatherly way and abandoned to the cruel sway of the devil? Let us now turn our attention to this issue with reference to common human experience. It can be shown that forgiveness and justice are balanced and can coexist and do not always contradict each other. Sometimes justice demands that forgiveness must be extended, and sometimes it demands that forgiveness be withheld. If a child is forgiven and is encouraged to commit more crime, then forgiveness is itself bordering on a crime and is against the sense of justice. If a criminal is forgiven only to perpetrate more acts of crime and creates suffering all around him because he is forgiven and encouraged, that would also be against the dictates of justice and will be tantamount to an act of cruelty to other innocent citizens. There are countless criminals of this type who are covered by the atonement of Jesus. That in itself is contrary to justice. But if a child repents, for instance, and the mother is convinced that the same crime will not be repeated, then to punish the child would be counter to the sense of justice. When a repentant person suffers, that in itself is a punishment which may in some cases far exceed a punishment imposed from outside. People with a living conscience always suffer after committing a sin. As a consequence, the cumulative effect of the repeated pangs of conscience reaches a point where it may result in God taking pity on such a weak, oft faltering, oft repenting servant of His. This is the lesson in the relationship of justice to forgiveness, which people of high intellect or even people of ordinary understanding draw alike from a universal human experience. It is high time that Christians woke up from their dormant state of accepting Christian dogma without ever questioning its wisdom. If they re-examine Christian doctrine in the light of common sense and reasoning, they may still remain good practicing Christians, but of a different and more realistic type. They would then believe even more and with greater love and dedication in the human reality of Jesus, as compared to the Christ, who is a mere figment of their imagination and no more real than fiction. Jesus' greatness lies not in his legend, but in the supreme sacrifice of Jesus, the man and messenger. A sacrifice which moves the heart far more powerfully and profoundly than the myth of his death upon a cross and his revival from the dead after spending a few ghastly hours in hell. Jesus cannot possibly atone. Last but not least, how could Jesus be born innocent when he had a human mother? If the sin of Adam and Eve had polluted the entire progeny of this unfortunate couple, then as a natural consequence, all male and female children must inherit the same genetic propensity to sin. Females were perhaps more likely to, because it was Eve who, as the instrument of Satan, enticed Adam. Therefore, the responsibility of sin falls squarely on the shoulders of Eve rather than of Adam. In the case of the birth of Christ, obviously it was the daughter of Eve who contributed the major share. The question that very powerfully arises is whether Jesus inherited any gene-bearing chromosomes from his human mother or not. If he did so, then it was impossible for him to escape the inevitable inherited sin. If he did not inherit any chromosomes from his mother either, then indeed that birth would be doubly miraculous. Only a miracle could produce a son who neither belongs to his father nor to his mother. What remains incomprehensible is why those chromosomes provided by Eve did not carry the innate tendency to sin to the child Jesus. Suppose it happened somehow, and Jesus had the innocence needed to carry the sins of mankind on condition that they believed in him and not otherwise. Another problem would arise. What happened, one may ask, to the progeny of Adam and Eve that died before the dawn of Christianity? How many billions of them might have got scattered throughout the world over 5 continents, generation after generation? They must have lived and died without hope or even the possibility of ever hearing about the Christ, their Savior, who was not yet born. In fact, the entire humanity between Adam and Christ seemed certainly to be doomed forever. Why were they never given even a remote chance to be forgiven? Would they be forgiven retrospectively by Jesus Christ? If so, why? In other parts of the world, much larger by comparison to the tiny land of Judea, where people had never heard of Christianity even during the lifetime of Jesus Christ, what happens to them? They never did, nor ever could, believe in the sonship of Jesus Christ. Will their sins go unpunished, or will they be punished? If they go unpunished, for what reason? If they are punished, again, by what logic? What chance did they have anyway? They were totally helpless. What a distorted sense of absolute justice. Unwilling sacrifice. Now let us turn to the act of crucifixion itself. Here we are confronted with another insoluble dilemma. Jesus, as we are so insistently told, offered himself voluntarily to God the Father and was made the scapegoat for sins of all humanity, provided, of course, they believed in him. But when the time of acceptance of his wish approaches nigh, and at last the glimmer of hope for sinful humanity is beginning to appear like the dawn of a new day, as we turn to Jesus expecting to observe his joy, his happiness, and his ecstasy at this most eventful moment of human history, how profoundly disappointed and manifestly disillusioned we are. Instead of finding a Jesus impatiently awaiting the hour of jubilation, what we see instead is a Jesus weeping and crying and praying and beseeching God the Father to take away the bitter cup of death from him. he severely reproached one of his disciples when he caught him in the act of dozing off after spending such a fateful long day and suffering through a dark, gloomy night which bade ill for him and his holy master. The biblical account of this incident goes as follows. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane and said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." He went a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Matthew 26, verses 36 through 43. Alas, as the Christian story unveils itself, the prayers and beseeching of neither Jesus nor his disciples were accepted by God the Father, and willingly, despite his strong protestations, he was at last crucified. Was he the same person, the same prince of innocence and paragon of sacrifice, who so bravely volunteered himself to take the burden of all of mankind's sins on his shoulders? Or was it a different person? His conduct, both at the hour of the crucifixion and during the crucifixion itself, strongly casts shadows of doubt either on the identity of Jesus Christ or on the truth of the myth spun around his person. But of that later. Let us now return to our critical examination where we left it. Some other questions which arise from the last cry of agony by Jesus Christ are as follows. Who uttered those deeply pathetic and touching words? Was it Jesus the man, or was it Jesus the Son? If it was Jesus the man who was abandoned, by whom and why? If we accept this option, it would also have to be taken for granted that till the last, Jesus the man retained a single independent identity which could think and feel freely and individually. Did he die at the moment of parting of the soul of Jesus the Son of God from the body of the man he had occupied? If so, why and how? If it was so, and it was the body of man which died after the soul of God deserted it, then the question would arise as to who got revived from the dead when the soul of God revisited the same body later on. Again, this option would lead us to believe that it was not Jesus the Son who was suffering, But the person of Jesus, the man who cried out in such agony, and he was the one who suffered while Jesus the Son looked on in a state of total indifference and apathy. Then how can he justify the claim that it was he, the Son, who suffered for the sake of humanity and not the man in him? The other option is that we presume it was Jesus the Son who cried out, while the man in him, perhaps hopeful to begin a new life for himself, washed on in uncertain expectancy of the realization that along with the sacrifice of Jesus the Son, he, Jesus the man, whether he liked it or not, would also be slaughtered on the altar of his innocent cohabitor. What sense of justice ever motivated God to kill two birds with the same stone is perhaps another mystery. If Jesus the Son it was, and it was him indeed according to the general consensus of Christian churches, then the second question arising out of the answer of the first would be about the identity of the second party involved in that monologue of Jesus in Matthew 26 verses 39 and 42. We have two options open to us. One, that the Son was addressing the Father, complaining that he was abandoned in the hour of need. This inescapably leads us to believe that they were two different persons who did not coexist in a single, mutually merged personality, equally sharing all attributes and putting them into play simultaneously with equal share. One appears to be the supreme arbiter, the all-powerful possessor of the ultimate faculty of taking decisions. The other, the poor son, seems to be entirely deprived or maybe temporarily dispossessed of all the domineering characters which his father enjoyed. The central point which must be kept in focus is the fact that their opposite wills and wishes nowhere seem more at odds and at variance with each other than they were during the last act of the crucifixion drama. The second question is, would these two distinct persons with individual thoughts, individual values, and individual capacities feel pain and agony if they were two in one and one in two? So another question would require many a long dialogue between theologians regarding the possibility of God being able to suffer pain and punishment. Even if so, only half of God would suffer while the other half was incapable of doing so by design or by the compulsion of his nature. As we proceed further in the shadowy world of this twisted philosophy, light begins to get dimmer and dimmer, and we find confusion heaped upon confusion. Another problem is that, whom was Christ addressing if he was God himself? When he addressed his Father, he himself was an inseparable part of the Father, so we are told. So what was he saying and to whom? This question must be answered with a free conscience, without resorting to dogma. It becomes a dogma only when it cannot be explained in human terms. According to the biblical statement, when Jesus was about to give up the ghost, he cried, addressing God the Father, "Why have you abandoned me?" Who had abandoned whom? Had God abandoned God? Who was sacrificed? The other problem we have to take note of is that the man in Jesus was not punished, nor by any logic should he have been punished. because he had never opted to carry the load of humanity's sin. This new element, entering into the debate, leads us to a very peculiar situation which we have not considered before. One is compelled to wonder about the relationship of the man in Jesus with the inherited propensity to commit sin common to all the progeny of Adam and Eve. At best, one can bring oneself to believe that in the duality of the divine Son and the man occupying the same body, it was only the divine Son who was innocent. But what about the man living alongside him? Was he also born out of genes and character provided by God? If so, then he should behave like the divine in Jesus, and no excuse would be acceptable if he goes remiss in this or that, with the plea that he only did so because he was a man. If there was nothing of God in him, that is, in the man in Jesus, then we must concede that he was simply an ordinary human being, perhaps half a human being. Yet that human person, amalgamated with Jesus, has to be human enough to inherit the disposition to sin. If not, why not? Obviously, there is no gain in saying that being a man distinctly separate from his divine partner, he must have sinned independently with the entire responsibility of sin upon his human shoulders. This scenario will not be complete without presenting Jesus, the Son of God, dying, not so unselfishly after all, for the sake of humanity, but his prime concern might have been for his half-brother, the man in him. All this is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to digest intellectually. But from our point of view, there is no problem. It was the innocent person Jesus the man, without there being any duality in him, who uttered this cry of astonishment and agony. The dilemma of Jesus. Let me once again make it clear that I do not disbelieve in Jesus, but have profound respect for him as a messenger of God with exceptional sacrifices to his credit. I understand Jesus to be a holy man, going through a period of great trial. But as the narration of the act of crucifixion begins to unfold and come to a close, we are left with no choice but to believe that Jesus did not volunteer himself for death upon the cross. The night before the day his enemies attempted to murder him by crucifixion, we hear him praying all night, along with his disciples, because the truth of his claim was at stake. It is said in the Old Testament that an impostor who attributes things to God which he had never said would be hanged on a tree and die upon it an accursed death. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name and anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, must be put to death. Deuteronomy 18, verse 20. And if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but you shall bury him the same day. For a hanged man is accursed of God. Deuteronomy 21, verses 22, 23. Jesus knew that if this happened, the Jews would celebrate with ecstasy and proclaim him to be an impostor whose falsehood had finally been proved beyond a shadow of doubt on the authority of divine scriptures. This was the reason why he was so anxious to escape the bitter cup of death. Not out of cowardice, but out of fear that his people would be misled and would fail to recognize his truth if he died upon the cross. All night he prayed, so piteously and helplessly that to read the account of his agony and misery is heartrending. But as this real life drama proceeds to a close, the climax of his emotional distress, dejection, and hopelessness is fully displayed in his last cry, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" One must notice that it was not agony alone expressed in that cry, but obviously there was mingled with it an element of surprise, bordering on horror. After he was brought back to consciousness with the help of some of his dedicated disciples who applied to his wounds an ointment they had prepared before crucifixion and which contained all the ingredients needed for mitigating pain and healing wounds, he must have been so wonderfully and happily surprised, and his faith in a loving, true God would have been reinstated and revitalized in a manner seldom experienced by man in its intensity and boundlessness. The fact that the ointment had been prepared in advance constitutes a strong proof that Jesus' disciples were indeed expecting him to be delivered from the cross alive, very much in need of medicinal treatment. From the above, it becomes comfortingly clear that the concept of inherited sin and of crucifixion are based only on the conjecture and wishful thinking of Christian theologians at a later date. It is quite likely that it was born out of some pre-Christian myths of a similar nature, which, when applied to the circumstances of Jesus Christ, tempted them to read close similarities between the two and create a similar myth. However, whatever the mystery or paradox, as we see it, there is no evidence whatsoever that the Christian philosophy of sin and atonement was based on anything which Jesus might have said or done or taught. He could never have preached anything so contrary to and so diametrically opposed to human intellect. Did God the Father suffer as well? Coming to the nature of the Son, we cannot believe that he was thrown into hellfire, as that would mean an internal contradiction with himself. Returning to the basic concept of Christianity, it is said that God and the Son are two persons but of the same nature and substance. It is impossible for one to go through an experience while the other does not share in it. How can we believe that one aspect of God the Son was being tormented while God the Father remained unscathed? If he did not suffer, it would be tantamount to breaking the unity of God. Three persons in one becomes even more inconceivable because the experiences of each constituent of Trinity have turned out to be so different and remote from each other that it appears impossible for one God to be in the raging fire of hell and at the same time the other to remain perfectly aloof and untouched. There is no other choice for the Christians of today but either to sacrifice the unity of God and believe in three different gods, like the pagans of pre-Christianity, such as Romans and the Greeks, or they remain true to themselves and believe that God is one, and as such, two aspects of God cannot undergo contradictory states. When a child suffers, it is impossible for the mother to remain calm and peaceful. She must suffer as well, sometimes more than the child. What was happening to God the Father when he made his son suffer the agony of 3 days in hell? What was happening to God the Son? Was he divided into two persons, with two forms and substance? One form suffering in hell and the other completely outside, not suffering at all? If God the Father was suffering, then what was the need of creating the Son, when he himself could have suffered? So this is a very direct question. Why did he not just suffer for himself? Why draw out such a difficult plan to resolve the problem of forgiveness? The punishment of fire. Here, the question of hell to which, according to the Christian doctrine, Jesus was confined to, should be examined more closely. What sort of hell was it? Was it the same hell we read about in the New Testament, which says, "The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Matthew 13:41-42. Before we proceed further, it has to be very clearly understood what the New Testament means by the punishment of fire or the punishment of hell. Is it a fire which burns the soul, or is it a carnal fire which consumes the body and thereby tortures the soul? Do the Christians believe that after death we will return to the same body which the soul left behind to disintegrate to earth and ashes, or will there be a new body created for each soul and the resurrected person would experience a sort of reincarnation? If it is carnal fire and corporeal punishment, then one has to extend one's imagination to the limit of its tethers as to what may have happened in the case of Jesus Christ. Before being subjected to the fire, was his soul re-imprisoned in the body of the man he had been haunting all his life on earth, or was he somehow relegated to an astral body? If the latter is the case, then that astral body would have been beyond the reach of the carnal fire of hell to scorch, punish, or destroy. On the other hand, if we accept the scenario that the body of the man he had occupied would be reconstructed for Jesus as a sort of medium through which he could suffer hell, then one cannot fail to notice another blow done to the principle of divine justice. Poor man. First of all, he was practically hijacked for all his life by an alien soul. But then, as a reward for the hospitality forced upon him, he would burn in hell for no crime of his own, the credit of his sacrifice being totally monopolized by the alien occupant within him. Again, what about the soul of that man? Or perhaps he did not have a soul of his own. If not, then the man in Jesus and the God in Jesus had to be one and the same person, and the plea that Jesus acted sometimes by his human impulses and sometimes by divine will is reduced to sheer hocus pocus. The only formula acceptable to any intellect is that one soul and one body equals one person. Two souls and one body is a bizarre idea which can only be entertained by those who believe in people being haunted by ghosts or similar things. Sacrifice and spiritual bliss. If the second option is more acceptable to the Christian theologists, in that it assumes only the soul of Jesus to have entered hell and that hell to be a spiritual hell, if so, there seems to be no reason why we should reject this suggestion as nonsensical. However, the spiritual hell is only created by pangs of conscience or a sense of guilt. In the case of Jesus Christ, neither was applicable. When you accept the penalty of another's crime, being innocent yourself, it is not pangs of conscience which are generated, but quite the opposite. The soul of such a person should vibrate with a sense of nobility and self-sacrifice, which would be tantamount to spiritual heaven rather than hell. Now we turn to the question of the body that was occupied by Jesus and the meaning of death in relation to that body, and also to the meaning of revival in the same context. To the best of our knowledge, the body of Jesus Christ had to be an integral part of the sonship of Jesus. Otherwise, he would have no common meeting ground left to him for his divinity and humanity to merge upon and play distinctly different roles under certain conditions. At times, we should see the man taking charge of affairs, provided he had a separate soul himself, and at times, we should observe the divine asserting himself and controlling the man's faculties of head and heart. Again, we emphasize that this can happen only if there are two distinct personalities locked up in a single being. Meaning of death in relation to Christ. Having clearly understood the different options regarding the relative roles that the divine and the man in Jesus could have played, we try to comprehend the application of the word death and its full meaning in relation to him. If he died for 3 days and nights, then death has to be understood in terms of the soul having been severed from the body and the soul departing, which means that the soul must depart the body and break off its relationship so completely that only a very dead core is left behind. So far, so good. Jesus was at least relieved of his imprisonment in the carnal body of a man. However, liberation from this imprisonment should not be considered a punishment at all. The return of the divine soul of the Son to the same sublime state of existence cannot be treated in any way like ordinary human death. Human death is fearsome not because the soul leaves the body and severs the ties by gaining a new consciousness, but the horrors of death are mainly on the account of one's permanently severing ties with many a dear ones left here on earth, and leaving behind one's possessions and different objects of love. Many a times it so happens that a man who has nothing to live for prefers to die rather than live an empty life. In the case of Jesus, the feeling of remorse could not have been present. For him, the window of death was open only in one single direction, that of gain and not of loss. Why should his departure from the body be considered an extremely pitiable and agonizing experience? Again, if he died once and literally, not metaphorically, gave up the ghost, as the Christians would have us believe, then returning to the same body is the most unwise step attributed to him. Was he reborn when he returned to the body that he had abandoned during the hour of death? If this process is only to be described as a revival or resurrection of Jesus, then the body should also have been eternalized. But what we read in the Bible is a completely different story. According to that story, Jesus was resurrected from the dead by entering the same body in which he had been crucified, and that was called his regaining of life. That being so, what would be the meaning of the act of his abandoning the body once again? Would that not be tantamount to a second death? If the first departure from body was death, then most certainly the second time he is considered to have abandoned the human body, he should be declared eternally dead. When the soul abandons the body first time, you call it death. When it returns to the same body, you call it life after death. But what would you call it when the soul leaves the same body once again, never to return? Will it be called eternal death or eternal life? According to the Christian jargon, it has to be eternal death and nothing more. Contradiction upon contradiction. A very nerve-wracking experience indeed. If it is suggested that the body was not abandoned the second time, then we have the strange scenario in which God the Father exists as an infinite incorporeal spiritual being, while the Son remains trapped in the restricted confines of mortal existence. Limited suffering for unlimited sin. It may be suggested that it is not always the pangs of conscience which create a miserable state of mind and heart in those who are sensitive to their faults. On the other hand, intense sympathy for the sufferings of others may also create a life of agony for someone who is totally or partially innocent of crime, but has the sublime spiritual quality of suffering for the sake of others. That would also create a similitude of hell. Mothers suffer for their ailing babies. The human experience stands witness to the fact that sometimes, for a permanently disabled child, the entire life of the mother is turned into a living hell. So why cannot we concede to Jesus that noble quality of being able to suffer for the sake of others? Why not indeed? But why only 3 days and nights? Why not for his entire sojourn on earth, and even before and after that? Noble people do not suffer only temporarily for a very limited period of hours or days. Their hearts do not rest in peace unless they see a misery mitigated or alleviated entirely. The hell which we are considering is not the prerogative of an innocent divine person only. It is a noble quality shared to some degree even by the beasts of the jungle for their near ones. After a few more remarks, I will rest this case, but I have one other important issue to briefly touch upon. The punishment prescribed by God for Jesus Christ only lasted for 3 days and three nights, while the sinners for whom he was punished had committed sins so horrible and for so long that, according to the Bible, their punishment was to be eternal suffering in hell. So what sort of a just God was it that, when it came to the punishment of those created by him, people who were not his sons or daughters, they were to be punished eternally? But when it came to the punishment of his own son, for sins he had voluntarily taken upon himself, suddenly the punishment was reduced. Only 3 days and three nights. No comparison whatsoever. If this is justice, then let justice not be. How would God look at the conduct of human beings he has himself created with his right hand if they dispense justice as they learned it from him, applying different measures to their own children and very different to those of others? Will God the Father watch this loyal imitation with ecstasy or horror? Very difficult indeed to answer. What did atonement change? As far as the effect of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in relation to the punishment of sin is concerned, we have already established that faith in Jesus Christ has in no way reduced the punishment of sin prescribed by God for Adam and Eve and their progeny. All human mothers still bear their children with the pains of labor, and it is still with labor that man earns his bread. If we consider it from another angle, a broad comparison between the Christian and non-Christian world since the time of Jesus Christ, no believers in Christ can show a remarkable change in any period of history of their women delivering their children without pain and their men earning their bread without labor. They do not show any difference in this regard in comparison to the non-Christian world. As far as the disposition to commit sins is concerned, the world of believers in Christ compared with the world of non-believers do not record any evidence that the dispensation to commit sin is totally obliterated among the category of believers in Christ. In addition to this, one may indeed wonder why having faith in God is considered so inferior to having faith in His Son. This is especially relevant to the time before this tightly kept age-old secret that God had a Son was disclosed to mankind. Of course, there were people who had faith in God and His unity. Also, innumerable people were born since Christ in every religion and land of the earth, who believed in God and His oneness. Why didn't faith in God bear any influence on human crime and punishment? Again, why could not God the Father display the nobility of suffering for the sake of sinners, which His nobler Son displayed? Most certainly, the Son seems to possess higher moral values, God forbid, than His less civilized father. Is divinity evolving and still in the process of attaining perfection, one may ask?